Broadcasting worldwide on internet radio.
Refreshing takes on legal strategies.
Straightforward answers to difficult tax questions.
Independent ideas on building wealth. The Refresher Wealth Show with Mark Kohler and Matt Sorensen.
Previously recorded with Mark as the host of The Mark Kohler Show.
Enjoy this fresh take on strategies to better live the American dream.
Well, welcome everybody to today's show. My name is Mark Kohler. Excited to be here with you. We've got an incredible show planned. I think you're going to love it. I'm so thrilled to be with you here on this crisp, beautiful tax season day. Does it feel like tax season to some of you? Well, it does to us over here. I know. This is probably not a good time of year for some of you. It's a little stressful for us, too. But welcome to all you that might be new listeners as well. We're a law firm, accounting firm, helping clients around the country. I've been hosting this show for 5+ years, helping entrepreneurs just live the dream, save taxes, build wealth, protect it, avoid the scams out there. And today we have got an exciting show about your reputation. Let me just say this. For some of you that are regular listeners, a lot of times, you know, we kind of go into our tax and legal tips for the first half of the show, and then at the bottom of the hour, we welcome our guests. But we're going to flip that around today. I've got my special guest here I'm going to introduce in a moment. We're going to bring him out on the line for the first half of the show, and then we'll talk about some tax and legal tips here at the second half. I just had an article published by UPS.com in their blog section for small business owners on 5 tax tips before you file. And I want to go through those. I think this is important for all of you to kind of sharpen your pencil and look at. If you're, of course, a client of ours, we're going to be doing that anyway with you. But I think for all of you out there, this is good stuff to kind of make a note, talk to your preparer, or if you're planning on TurboTax, get it figured out. But we're going to be going through some legal tips here in the bottom half, and we'll be rocking it. First, our reputation. Now, I want to set the stage here because I had a client literally just recently called me up, frantic, very, very upset. He had some really bad things being said about him and his company on the web, and it was some of these kind of bulletin board sites where anybody can post anything and no one cares if they're true or not, and they can get a lot of hits and traffic quickly. And it was very, very damaging to him. He was very upset, and I think it was more, sometimes maybe his pride, but also if you just Googled his company and his name, it was on that first page, some of this garbage out there. So he had us immediately start writing nasty letters and legal letters, and frankly, there wasn't much we could do. These companies that sponsor these sites, at least from my experience, and we're going to hear from our expert today, they really don't care if you get a nasty letter from a lawyer. They kind of like that free speech concept. So it's tough. So he engaged a company called ReputationBuilder.com, had a very positive experience, was keeping me posted throughout the process, and I was actually shocked at how bad it could have gotten and what he was able to do to work on his company's reputation online. He and his wife are both owners of the business. Both of them don't want to make it. It wasn't a single owner. But they really had a tough go at it. And things are good now. You go Google them. The homepage is clean. And they feel like they've protected one of their most valuable assets. And see, protecting our reputation can be just as valuable as a building or a concept or a service we're providing. And so since I talk about asset protection, and we're talking about that American dream and what we need to do it, I think this is an absolutely critical topic that I've put off way too long. So without further ado, let me introduce Michael Zamuto. He is the president, founder, and chief operations officer of ReputationBuilder.com. He's dynamic, multi-award-winning online and technology executive with a history that spans multiple successful startups and large technology firms, the top 40 website and leadership role with Microsoft. And we're just grateful to have him here with us on the show from the East Coast. Mike, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me, Mark.
Hey, you bet, man. We're excited to have you here. Now, just exactly where are you located? Do you find a little kind of spring, winter weather, or are you you're chilling in the sun today?
No, unfortunately, Reputation Changer is located out of Philadelphia. We've got offices in Savannah, Georgia, but I'm not there today. And so I'm in our corporate headquarters in suburban Philadelphia.
Okay. Well, all right. Well, that's all right. Now, you just said something there. I want to clarify right away. My team and your Eric Zeblum and some of the information I gathered from you, I'm embarrassed here. ReputationChanger.com, I know, but also ReputationBuilder.com. Which one do you prefer to go by?
Reputation Changer is the company's name, and that's the primary website where you can go and sign up for free monitoring and things like that.
Okay. All right. I apologize. I have one of your bios that was came through that had the Reputation Builder the term. So I apologize. So we're still with Reputation Changer Day. Well, gosh, Mike, tell me. I mean, my little story that I shared a minute ago, is that you? Is that typical? Are you seeing that often in your business? I suppose so.
Yeah, Mark, the experiences of your client happen every day around the world to, you know, millions of companies and individuals. And your description of that person's experience is what we hear all day, every day. And our clients range from individual consumers up to Fortune 100 businesses and governments, foreign governments, and so on. And what everybody is discovering is, just like you said, what's said about you online, specifically through the results of Google, because a trillion searches a year happen through Google. 96% of what people view off those sites come off the first couple of pages. And so what people see about you when you Google yourself really tells them a lot about how to think about you or your company or organization. And that's where we come in and help people.
Now, I know today we're excited to ask you about some of the things we should be doing and some of the things we shouldn't be doing. I guess one of the, I think, have you Googled your name recently? Should people probably do that on a regular basis? Just kind of type their name in the web and see what comes up. That's the first step, I guess.
Yeah, that's actually the first tip we give people is you should Google yourself and see what other people see when they do that. And people sort of chuckle at that when we first tell them, like, you know, maybe it's sort of vanity or something like that. But in fact, the single largest category of searches on the internet is people searching for themselves or their own business, believe it or not. And that's a very healthy thing. We tell people that they should search regularly. Now, once you've searched and you look at what's there and you see how people see you, think about how you want them to see you and then go sign up for free monitoring and alerts on ReputationChanger.com. And then start thinking about what you want people to really see and how you're going to get there.
Now, this really isn't a privacy thing either. I mean, you're not really worried about privacy. You're worried about what's public. Is that a fair point? Or are you helping people try to hide?
I mean, I think we live on the internet today. Over $1.6 billion worth of retail sales involve some level of online research. 70% of employers said they've excluded a candidate based on something they found online. So it's not a matter of not appearing on the internet or trying to be anonymous. You have to have an online presence of some kind. And over the last 10 years, things like social networks, review sites, which may be what your client was facing, and other platforms like that, government information sites, these things have conspired together to put more information about us on the internet than was ever available before. And that just increases the need for you to take control of those things and really start putting in there things that tell your story.
Do you concern yourself with privacy if clients call you up and say, hey, I really want you to help hide me, and I don't want this address getting out there? Is that something you guys provide?
Well, it's funny you mentioned that. That's actually one of our more secretive offerings. We have an offering called Identity Protection, and largely this is about people of some sort of prominence. A good example is law enforcement personnel who very much don't want their private information posted online. You can imagine if you're a drug enforcement agent, the last thing you want is information about your kid's soccer game being the first thing that shows up when people search for your name. And so in that case, we'll actually produce fictional people with your name and have that stuff ranked so it becomes difficult to find you.
Oh, okay. Now, that's interesting because there's, many of my listeners are small business owners that are wanting to be found, or at least their business to be found, but then on the flip side, you may have clients come to you that say, I don't want anybody to find me. So really, you could manipulate either end of that, huh?
You certainly can. I mean, again, it's about taking a look at those first couple of pages and saying, what do I want people to see when they come there? What's the story I want them to know about me? And you're right, in a small number of cases, there isn't one. But for most people, they really use those search engine results as a way to promote themselves personally or professionally, build a brand, build a following, engage with people. And we want people to think beyond just their website, but actually think of all 10 things that are on the first page as slots, chances for you to tell different parts of your story.
Okay. Now, let's say I do search my site and I search my name and something bad comes up. What's the first thing I should do? I guess probably engage with you guys a little bit won't hurt, but what can I do initially?
The first thing is to have, good alerts set up so that you don't wait until you search to find them. You know, you can go to reputationchanger.com, sign up for free alerts and monitoring. You put in your own keywords. You can go there and manage your own social media properties. But when something comes up that's negative about you, then you have to look at it and decide what can be done. And your point earlier about sites ignoring takedown notices, which is the term that goes to those things, is very true. There have been plenty of legal precedents that shows that most of these sites can articulate their position as being just a conduit to put conduit information online. And so they bear no responsibility for verifying the person who posts it, finding out if it's a competitor or a former employee, let alone validating that it's true or that it might be, accurate and up to date. And so what you've got to do is really be honest with yourself as to whether or not you can do anything to get that taken down. And in most cases, you can't. And when you can't, you should focus on suppressing that negative by pushing more positive things about you higher up in it. And there's a number of techniques that, people can do on their own on a small basis, but then on a larger basis, a reputation changer can do by creating new assets or making the ones that are there rank more effectively.
Okay. Being proactive, what are some things I shouldn't do? Like, if I'm worried about my reputation online, is there some things that I should just never do? Anything come to mind? That you tell your clients, of course.
There's a lot of tips I can give your listeners. The first thing is be careful about getting into debates. One of the very common mistakes we see out of people is that if something comes on about them negative on a site, let's say it's one of these mugshot sites or it's one of these review sites where people have said, mostly good things but maybe some bad things about their business, the natural thing to want to do is to go on and defend yourself or to defend your business and to hear your side of the story. Surprisingly, this has a negative side to it that you don't expect, which is the more engagement, the more activity that happens on these sites, the more likely they are to show up as the top few rankings when you search for your name, right? And so it can be counterproductive.
Yeah.
And so it can sometimes be painful, but with sites like, let's take Yelp, for example, which is a popular review site, when those things come up, sometimes the best thing to do is just ignore them and focus instead on telling your story. Make sure that people who are searching for you, which again is far and away the most common way people are going to find you or your business, make sure that when they search for you, they find things that you control. If you don't control it, then don't assume it'll stay positive forever.
Okay. Now, folks, many of you that are longtime listeners of me know that you can ask questions via the chat window or the email, and I've got an email question that just came in. But let me repeat, if anybody would like to call in and ask Mike a question, please do so. The number is 646-200-4285. That's 646-200-4285. And if you want to just email me a question, of course, mark@markjkohler.com, or just type something out of the chat window. Of course, we're still here talking with Mike Thamuto, Chief Operations Officer of ReputationChanger.com. Excited to have him here with us. Okay, the question I just got here, Mike, is someone asked, hey, Mike, does it help me to write blog? Oh, sorry, we're getting a little bit of feedback there, Mike. Are you still there, Mike, with us?
I sure am. I'm here, yes.
Okay, good, good. Hey, the question we had just via email was, they said, hey, Mike, is it helpful to write blog articles? Is that going to help suppress any bad press?
Yeah, blogs are a great place to start. Blogs have a few advantages to them. One of them is that they're really easy to update. And so in addition to social media, these can be things that fill up a number of slots. Imagine you want to take control of those search engine results, and as I mentioned, by default, it's 10 slots. If you go out and sign up for four or five social media sites and then a blog, you've already taken care of five or six of them in most cases, unless you have a common name. And the thing about blogs is there's a trick to that. The ones that Google owns will actually rank better. So Blogger and Blogspot are ones that Google owns, and those will rank better than WordPress, which otherwise has a really good blog.
Oh, okay. Okay, very good. What are some other things I can do to – I mean, this is where SEO, search engine optimization strategies, come into play, of course, to get those 10 slots. But what other things do you see clients doing that makes sense to get those positions?
Well, another thing is to think about, this is what Reputation Changer does really well, is think about what the search engines want to rank based on. And here's what they're looking for. They want high quality content. They want engaged readers. They want it to be relevant. And Google in particular are masters at building algorithms to judge those things. And so you cannot fake it. You can't trick the search engine, certainly not for any period of time. What you need to do is to really focus on telling your story in a really compelling way. You know, make them long-form content. You have it be deep and rich and really put some energy into it. And if you can't, then get someone to do it for you. And this is the type of thing that we do for our clients. So our business is, you know, part SEO, but it's really a lot about the content strategy and what our journalists and editors will help craft that story so that it's something that Google will value as much as you do.
Well, it's ironic you bring that up. I had another email here. Someone asked, do you provide copy editing services to help me with my message? Is that something you guys do?
We do. We actually employ dedicated professional journalists, editors, and writers, and the writers are actually divided up into several different groups. So we have writers that just focus on news articles, ones that focus on websites for our clients. We have a whole team of people specializing in each of the major social networking sites. And so, yes, we have people focusing on those writing. And the thing that we've learned is that in order to do a really good job there and to be engaging and have it rank well in search engines, you have to really understand how those different platforms work so that you can optimize that content to really fit the use.
My listeners, you guys know this. This is not an infomercial for any one particular guest, and I apologize, Mike. I feel like I'm just like teeing it up for you on every question here with your wonderful company. But this is something a lot of us haven't talked about, and I've often felt that, you know, I can't control what's out on the web. Why should I not have that feeling? Because I feel like it's just another cost. There's nothing I can do to control it. It's not worth it. What's wrong with that mentality that I'm sure many business owners share, like as I do?
Well, I think the only part of it that I think you should think about is whether it's worth it or not. So, you know, think about how your clients come to you. How do they learn about you, share information about you? Think about how the internet plays into it, and then think about the other money that you spend. I was just at a Fortune 100 CEO's office a few weeks ago, and he said to me after we were sort of analyzing a problem that had come up for them, you know, he said, you know, I spend a lot of time looking at how we spend our PR dollars. I spend a lot of time how we spend our advertising dollars. I haven't thought 1 minute this year about what our search engine results look like. And in his case, anyway, the negatives on there had undermined a lot of that hard work and money they had spent in those other areas. So think about what the return on these things might be. Think about what having people find the right story about you and not see negatives that maybe other people have written about you might impact on your business. And you might find there's a much better ROI than you think.
Well, I've got another question here via email, and this is someone that wanted to be anonymous. they said, is it possible, this may be Jeremy, my other attorney that's going to be giving us a tip here later. He's maybe using his wife's name here, but he asked, how do I get a picture that I don't want up on the web to not get around? it's a little more saucy of an email here, but I mean, they've got basically a salacious, that probably happens a lot. You got a salacious email out there, or a photo that you all of a sudden it's out there and you don't want it. What do you do?
Well, images are a big problem for people because it's even harder to change the rankings of images than it is for search engine results. And that's a specialty that we've developed. So we focus on, you know, news and Google's auto suggests, video and images. And those are, you know, kind of unusual focus for this industry. But, you know, we feel like it's important because, like your listener has pointed out, those things are also the ways people see about you. So in the case of images, you have to suppress them the same way you would negative search results, but it's much trickier.
Mm. What do you say about these websites that are like scam.com or this or that, and some kind of consumer protection website where they think they may be doing a service, maybe, and someone walks into your dentist's office and has a bad experience with a wisdom tooth removal and they want to go type on it. Can you do anything with that? Are most sites willing to remove things if you have another side of the story, or is it too late?
We call those review sites. And with all review sites, we think you should view them as inherently risky for your business. You don't control them. In almost all cases, they do nothing to validate who the people are or that the review is legitimate in any way. And we have an alternative suggestion for those sorts of reviews, which is, you know, add reviews to your own site and moderate them. It's very common for those sites to get, you know, bombarded with spam and you know, false reviews and former employees and competitors. And they don't feel like it's, as you pointed out, their obligation to do anything about it. But we can actually put a review widget on your own site, and you can moderate reviews and cut out the spammy ones and that sort of thing. I think review sites have a lot of potential, but if they're not going to validate who people are or do anything to really validate and give equal time, instead what they're doing is relying on the salaciousness of negative reviews. Here's the secret to review sites. People don't go for positive reviews, they go for negative reviews. And so as a result, no doubt some of your clients or listeners have seen that your business can have a lot of positive reviews on one of those sites, but if they have just one negative, it seems to show up very high in those listings, you know, very often, disproportionately high. And that's because negative sells.
Yeah, that's brutal. And the hard thing is, it's with all of our businesses. I'm sure someone's used reputationchanger.com that hasn't been happy. You know, someone's used my law firm or accounting firm that hasn't been happy. And so that's normal. No one can keep everybody happy 100% of the time. It's tough. But you say on those review sites, do you go in and respond to them? Like you said, maybe sometimes it'll increase the ranking of that. It's not, you have to be careful. I guess that's where they consult with you to find out if it's a good job or a good thing to do.
Yeah, we can help them with that. But in almost all cases, you know, we suggest to people that if you can't control the message on it, then treat it as a negative, a potential negative, and just in most cases stay away from it. Really what it's about is not trying to combat negatives. The internet is too anonymous and too big to really do that successfully. Instead, focus on telling your story. Tell the positive parts of it. Let people know about your new product offerings, your new markets, the great new talent that you've brought in, and focus on telling your part of the story. I mean, in the end, that's what we help people do, is we help them get their message out. The internet is a large, crowded, and noisy place, and people need help telling their story. And to your earlier point, it's worth doing. It matters, and it impacts your business.
Well, excellent. Now, I guess I just got another email, and again, folks, this is, I always try to give this disclaimer. I won't do it again, but this is my second and final disclaimers. Again, this is not per se an infomercial, but I really, you know, people really do need this service. There's not many companies like yours out there, Mike. So someone just emailed and asked, what are typical costs to get someone to monitor my reputation and help me fight things I don't like?
Well, that's the good news, is that the monitoring and alerts piece of it is completely free. You can come to reputationchanger.com. It's a free service. There's no obligation or cost or credit cards or any of that sort of stuff. You sign up, put your keywords in, you'll get alerts when you have negatives. And, you know, for some people, you can easily, you know, manage that stuff yourself and try building some of your own. And for a lot of clients, especially, you know, more prominent individuals, people with a problem, and then those, you know, larger companies and governments and those sort of groups that I mentioned before, they'll need professional help. They'll need experts who are specialists in it and can put the extra time and energy in, or they can combat attacks or online negatives. And that's where we come in. And so you can use the free tools to really determine, you know, which way for you to go. And then if you need help, we can design a campaign around it. Our campaigns average from a few thousand dollars up to hundreds of thousands of dollars a month for, you know, certain governments and really large companies.
Well, so if I'm a dictator of a small third world country, I may want to have your cell phone on my auto dial.
That would help.
Okay. Well, cool. Well, gosh. Well, any final words here with us? Maybe something we didn't cover that you're saying, Mark? When I have just a short window on a TV or a radio interview, people need to know something. Is there something we're missing here that I maybe haven't brought out in our conversation?
I think one other piece of advice to give people is to, you know, when you're posting yourself, always think about the audience. You know, think about your customers, your prospects, your grandmother, your boss. Think about all of those people being able to see everything you put on. It's a common mistake people make is they write something or post a picture intending one audience, and then they're surprised when other people see it, right? So that's something you've got to take advantage of. And to help your friend, the client who had the image problem, you know, Facebook has a great feature where you can require it to get your approval before you're tagged in a picture. And that can solve a lot of problems because people sometimes post your picture on Facebook. They don't mean anything malicious by it, but maybe they're not thinking about the professional implications.
Right. Okay. Well, very good. Well, Mike, thank you again for coming on the show. I really appreciate it. I know this is a busy time of day and year for you, and it's been a pleasure having you. Again, folks, we are here with Michael Zabuto, the president, founder, and CEO of ReputationBuilder.com. Check it out. I think it's something we all need. If we're going to have a strong web presence, we got to be looking at our reputation. So, Michael, thanks for being with us again.
Thank you very much for having me, Mark.
You bet. Hope to have you back. All right. Well, gosh, wow. Very interesting. I think that's really quite amazing, interesting information for me. I can't say it enough. For those that maybe joined us a little later, I recently had a client that just was maliciously attacked on the web. A lot of false things stated, and they were just mad about this the service they had when they went to my client's business. And that's going to happen. Some people have a bad experience, and my client was like, hey, I'll give you your money back, I'll do whatever, but they just were out to get him. Anyway, there wasn't much we could do with writing nasty letters or lawyer letters to try to stop them. And so he engaged Mike's office for this reputation changer type service, and he had a very positive experience. And now he's watching his reputation online much more closely, which, gosh, it's been an eye-opener to me because, again, in asset protection, our reputation can be one of our greatest assets. So, well, folks, we're here to the bottom of the hour. Now, you know, we're going to, as I said, flip things around here. We're going to hit some of these tax and legal tips here before we get through tax season. We got to cover these, and this is typically a very engaging time of the radio show where we can kind of see what we've got out there to save you guys some money and make you some money. I wanted to quickly share from my perspective the new article I just had picked up by UPS.com in their blog, and I was honored to be highlighted there and wanted to just kind of hit some of these last-minute tax tips. Now, when I wrote on this, and I'm going to give you my little venting here, tax planning is not done in March or April of the year. This is not a good time to be doing tax planning. This is, oh my gosh, I'm screwed. Let me see what I can dig up here to help me for last year. That's what we're going through right now. And so I've had Entrepreneur Magazine contact me almost daily this last couple of weeks. Mark, what are some of these last-minute tips Last minute tips, do your planning in December. That's my first one. Well, that doesn't cut it. We need some tips. I'm like, oh, for crying out loud, you know. So I've got an article coming out in Entrepreneur. You guys might find it interesting this coming week. I'll highlight it in my newsletter next week. But here I did highlight for UPS five things that I think many, many people don't write off enough. I think there's way too many conservative CPAs and tax preparers out there. They don't do a good job being aggressive in these five areas. And so I want to highlight a couple of these. And before I get going too far, we've got our other expert on the line. So I'll jump over to Jerem here for a moment. But let me highlight two of these, just kind of wet your whistle on these. First one is travel. Travel-related expenses. These include airfare, hotel, rental cars, valet, taxi, trains, tolls. The list goes on and on. And here's my problem with this. Not enough small business owners are finding a business reason for every trip they make. Now, my beautiful wife will tell you this is probably the bane of her existence, that every time we go on a trip, there's got to be some business purpose to it. I'm like, it'll make us some money. It'll make us a tax write-off. And she's often said, Mark, just show me you love me and take me on a trip that's not a write-off. And I'm working to that. I really am. But no, we take a lot of trips together. It's just usually there's a little business thing going on. But here's the point. Folks, when you're traveling, try to be meeting with a client, meeting with a vendor, attending a training meeting or an education course, tour a competitor's facility or store, have your annual board of directors meeting, a shareholder or manager meeting, conference or retreat with a partner. The list goes on and on. And this is where people travel can be such a huge write-off. Now here's my caveat. Here's my caveat to that, is that if you have a small business that's just getting going and you don't have a lot of income, the last thing I want to do is throw in $15,000 of business trips to go visit your friend that lives by grandma. That's not going to cut it. I mean, but for those of you that have a lot of small business activity and revenue, to travel, you should not shy away from it. I think this is a huge opportunity for you to take a lot of write-offs with travel and not be afraid to do it. The second one, real quick, on the same note of travel, is auto deductions. I think I mentioned this on a radio show in the last month, is that I had a new client that was really frustrated because their CPA was making them do a mileage log before they could even take mileage as a write-off on their tax return. And they were just shocked that the CPA was doing this rather than an IRS auditor. Now, should we have a mileage log? Yes. Should we do our best for that? Yes. Technically, should you have one? Yes. But if you don't, does that mean you completely walk away from your auto deduction? I say no. I think you need to have a reasonable, ethical, honest approach to your mileage for every one of your vehicles, whether they're an RV or motorcycle or car. We got to have something there to be taking advantage of the auto deduction, and not enough people are doing it. They just really shy away again from auto. Now, if you're going actual with an SUV or a truck, now we're talking fuel repairs, maintenance, and all that good stuff. But again, last year it was 55.5 cents per mile. So as you're digging up write-offs for last year, be generous with your mileage. If you get audited, you're going to have to validate it and legitimize it, but that's okay. You know, you can do it. This is possible. So anyway, those are two of my little five tips that I wanted to go through today, and we'll come back to those. If any of you have a thought or question on that, please send me an email right now. Let's do it. I don't mind if this turns into a little bit of an open forum. In fact, I might look at some of the questions we missed last week on the open forum. But without further ado, let me bring out my other expert with us today. We've got Jerem Bergeson, one of our lawyers here at the firm KKOS Lawyers, helping clients nationwide. He's an incredible business, contract, tax attorney, and also did some fighting in court. So we're excited to have him here with us. Jerem, how are you doing?
I'm doing great, Mark. How are you?
Good. Thanks for joining us today. Appreciate you kind of sharing some of your wisdom and knowledge with us.
Yeah, glad to be here. Although I heard earlier in the show you were, I think you were implying that there may be salacious photos of me on the internet, and that's just not true.
Well, I've seen a few. I maybe they're just floating around the office. That's it. Maybe I thought they were on the web. But
there you go.
You know, those Justin Bieber white tank tops, those are pretty hot items, so I just want to throw that out. All right, Bieber fever, that's all I'm saying.
You know
Bieber
it.
Bieber fever. All right. Well, what do you got for us this week? Have you heard a story that might you'd be able to share with us that could just change our world?
Well, I don't know if it'll change your world, but it was interesting that you mentioned that I do some fighting in court. We've got a client who we're representing in litigation up here who he's an electrician. He runs an electrician business. And back in 2004, his company did some work on about five or six houses in a new subdivision, just did electrical work inside and laid the cable from the house to the electrical box. And now, 9 years later, a few months back here in 2013, he was named in a lawsuit where the homeowners association had sued the developer, the builder, and a bunch of subcontractors, of which he was one, for drainage and soil issues on this property. And when he got named in the lawsuit, he brought it to us, and I looked at it, and we talked, and we kind of thought, why he's an electrician. Why is he named in this lawsuit? Well, I talked to the opposing counsel about that, and that attorney got back to me. He sent me a contract where our client, the electrician, had agreed to do trenching work, to actually dig the trench from the house to the electrical box. And that's why he was included in the lawsuit. So I took that information back to the client, and the client said, I never did that. I didn't do any trenching. I didn't dig anything. I didn't even put the dirt back in after I laid the cable. I just put the cable in the trench that somebody else dug. He said, I talked to the developer about that. I told them that I can't do that kind of work. I'm not insured to do it. And so he said that he and the developer had agreed that they weren't going to do that kind of work. They were just going to do the electrical work. The problem was the change never got put in the contract. So now he has to spend thousands of dollars in legal fees trying to clear his name and his business's name and get out of this lawsuit, where if he had just taken the time in the first place to put the change in the contract, to get it in writing, and we talk about that all the time, but if he had just gotten it in writing to start with, we wouldn't be here.
Wow. You know, this is this quote-unquote, I call this sometimes the change order problem.
Mm-hmm.
That many times when you hire a contractor, you could be on the other end of this. You could be the guy hiring the contractor, and you're asking them to do changes, and you're not getting it in writing. And then all of a sudden they want to get paid, and all
yep.
this verbal stuff comes up. I mean, this goes both ways. And change orders with contractors is really quite common. I mean, this shouldn't be a foreign concept for many of you out there, I would
no.
presume. On these change orders, they don't need to be. Let's go through a little details. They don't have to be notarized. I mean, how formal do these
no.
change orders have to be, Jeremy?
It really makes sense for them to obviously be in writing and then just signed by the two parties involved. No, they don't have to be notarized, but both parties should sign saying, yep, this is the change that's being made. This is this is what's being taken out of the previous contract. This is what we're adding in. These are the changes and we, you know, dated and signed, and you should be good.
Okay. How's it going to play out? Do you think our guy is going to get out?
I think he's going to be okay. He's got his own testimony that he didn't do this work. He's actually got testimony of the guy who worked for the developer who actually did the trenching saying, yeah, I did it. So I think we're going to be okay, but you know, we had to answer the lawsuit and participate in discovery, and these are expensive things, and it's very unlikely, unfortunately, that he'll get back any of these attorney's fees that he's having to expend to get out of this lawsuit.
Well, very good. Now, so the moral of the story, whenever you have a change in a I wanted to ask this. What about emails? Does an email satisfy a contract modification?
It will often depend on what the original contract said. Most contracts will say that there are no oral modifications, and any modification to this contract needs to be in a writing signed by all parties to the contract. If that's the case, an email is better than verbal, but it may not pass muster in a court of law.
Okay. Very interesting. But it's going to help. I mean, at least if you had it in an email.
An email. If he had an email, we might already be out of this case. I mean, an email would be good. The best is a writing that everybody signs. But an email is if we're going good, better, best, it's better but not best.
Okay. All right. Well, very good. Very good. Well, Jerem, thank you. Excellent tip. I myself have had problems hiring subcontractors to do work around the house over the years. And things always change. And if you can pull out a piece of paper and go, we're going to change the price or change the service, initial here, boy, would that save a lot of fights for everybody.
No doubt.
And it's not that subcontractors are I'm not villainizing the contractor. Many contractors are sick and tired of people making changes, too. It drives them nuts. So,
yeah,
I like it.
Yeah,
well,
it's
Jerem,
just
thank
important.
You very much.
If you're making changes, get them in writing.
I like it. Very good. Very good. Well, Jerem, thank you. You have an awesome day, and we're going to jump back into our tax and legal tips here for the rest of the hour, and I've got a few questions left over from the forum show last week I wanted to hit anyway. So this is going to turn into a power session here for the radio show. So thanks, Jerem, for being with us.
No problem, Mark. Thanks.
Thank you. All right. Well, folks, let me get back to these five tips real quick. I think these will, again, be very, very helpful to some of you digging up some of your expenses. Now, I want to say this, too. For many of you that are clients of ours already, we should be, my team, amazing, my personal tax consultant teams, the PTCs, they should be asking you for this data anyway. But let me remind you, there's three more expenses that I want all of you to be digging up, going through receipts, going through credit card statements, bank statements. These three other expenses can save you thousands. Just think if you dig up $4,000 to $5,000 in write-offs, that could be $1,000 to $2,000 in tax savings. That could pay for all of your tax prep and legal work for the year. You know, I mean, it could save a ton. This is a big deal. Now, okay, so number three, dining and entertainment. Folks, here's the technical rule. You do not have to have a receipt if it's less than $75. Now, I would like you to have a receipt. I'd like you to take your little iPhone, Android out and take a picture of the receipt, indicate who you had lunch or dinner with. That would be the technical thing, right thing to do. But, again, so many of us are going out to have lunch with friends, business owners, associates, vendors, clients, employees. We have got to take write-offs for that. Dining and entertainment should be a big write-off. You'd be shocked at how many new clients we have come to us that bring me their tax return and it has nothing there. It's just crazy. Dining and entertainment, we cannot overlook it. Now, don't forget, you can write off dining by yourself when you're outside of a normal commute of your home. So make sure that you're tracking dining when you're on your travel. Very, very important. Now, number four, office supplies and technology. This is one where many people don't take advantage of this because they don't keep the receipts or they pay for it with a personal credit card or checkbook. And that's when you're at the Apple store, when you're buying those little gadgets, iPads, computers, office supplies, Home Depot, anything that you're buying that could be used in your small business and you need to have in your small business, that is a write-off. And I want you to keep track of it. Now, if it's obviously used for person, I'm not saying be unethical or cheat on your taxes, but there's a lot of equipment that is used the majority of the time for your business. So do the best you can to create that and keep track of it. It's gonna be a great write-off in your tax return. Now, number five, without any further ado, is the telephone. Now, some of you may say, well, Mark, I write off my cell phone. Come on. But there's a couple things you need to know. Number one, in years past, a lot of CPAs would tell their clients to only write off a portion of their cell phone because they use part of the cell phone for their personal use. Well, there's been new court cases in the last 18 months, last year and a half, 2 years, that you can write off 100% of your cell phone, even if you use it for personal use, so long as you have a business, number one, and number two, you have a dedicated home line. So make sure you're tracking that. Now, again, for those of you that have been through my workshops or the webinar series of the CFO Inbox videos, you've heard these points. But the one that I don't probably emphasize enough that I want to mention is, again, with your family members. Make sure that your family members are writing on, you're writing off their cell phones if they're helping you in your business. That's another, my son right now, boy, I probably text him and call him daily to help me in my small business. I write off his cell phone as a business expense. He's a very important part of my business, and I need him. And so I'm going to be writing off his cell phone, and there's nothing wrong with that. That's good stuff. And don't be afraid of it. Good stuff. All right, now I wanted to grab a couple of these questions that came in on the open forum last week. And I'm just going to throw it out there again, because for those that are listening today, I want this to be a power-packed hour for you on the radio show. And if some of you have a question that I didn't hit on the open forum, please shoot me an email. Feel free, mark@markjkohler.com. And I've got three questions here that we weren't able to get to last week, and I think some of you are going to find these very enlightening. Now, number one is an S-Corp question, believe it or not. And this is why on the newsletter today, you saw a couple videos. I'm really getting much more active on my YouTube channel, trying to shoot more two-minute tax tips. I hope to have out 100 of those in the next 6 months. It's just these little two-minute tax tips. So tax and legal tips. So the I highlighted some on the S-Corporation. And so this is a question from Dave S. He says, Mark, let's say you have an S-Corp already, not an LLC, and hold and buy property. What are the pros and cons to this? Can I just leave the property in the S-Corp? I also plan to start fix and flips later this year. Okay, folks, this is a common problem. Sometimes people are doing business inside an LLC and really shouldn't be, and then other people that are doing business holding rental properties in an S-Corp, which they shouldn't be doing. So what I tell you, let me tell you the technical problem with this. When you hold property in an S corporation and you go to sell it, you're going to pay tax, appreciated gain tax. So let's say you buy a property for 100 grand and now it's worth 150 and it's in an S corp and you just transfer it out of your S corp for some reason, maybe to an LLC or in a partnership, you've got to pay tax on the appreciation, even if you really don't sell it. If you're just transferring it out of the S-Corp. So what happens is the rental property is kind of stuck in that S-Corp. So I want to recommend that if possible, if the property hasn't gone up in value, get it out of the S-Corp. You're going to have a lot more flexibility and options by getting that property into an LLC so that you could partner with others, do a 1031 exchange, use some IRA strategies maybe. I mean, who knows? But if it's in an S-Corp, your options are certainly going to be limited, so you want to be careful there. Dave, good question. Now, if you're going to be doing some fix and flips and there's a chance you're going to be selling this property down the road, just keep it in the S-Corp. I'm fine with that. But if you're thinking, Mark, I'm going to hold this rental for the next 20 years, then you probably want to be working to try to get it out of the S-Corp even sooner. We've got a question over here from Cy Young, and question is, I recently had big support from your team to set up the LLC. Thank you so much. And now I've got a question regarding my business deductions. I'm driving two company leased cars for my W-2 job. Wow, how would that be? Not only do they give you one leased car, they give you two. I'm paying for monthly fees and gas, but don't pay for insurance and maintenance. Well, on a leased car, there's probably not much maintenance. So at least you're getting the insurance covered. That's good. In this case, can I still deduct rental property-related miles? Well, yes. If you're paying for any use of this car, and then you're using the car after hours for your small business, then we're going to be able to take some write-off for that. If it is a lease, I may take a portion of the lease payment. Maybe I will do miles. So, Siyoung, we'd figure that out. Let me say, there is a write-off here. I'm not sure how much it would be based on the amount of use for business after your W-2 job, but there definitely is something there. Then also the question she follows here, I heard home office deductions such as rent and utilities should be based on square footage of office compared to square footage of the total home. I was wondering how accurate the percentage should be. Some people just say 50-50 is fine. And a CPA I used to work with said I should put the rent under the name of an entity and deduct 100%. I'd like to hear your opinion. Well, Siyoung, both of those options are unacceptable in my opinion. So let me repeat this for everybody. You do need to come up with a percentage of the use of your home based on the space for the office and the total square footage of the house. 50-50 is way too aggressive. On the flip side, Siyoung says that a CPA said, just write off 100% of it and claim the rent is a write-off, and then you can deduct 100% of the rent and utilities for your home business. Well, the problem with doing that is, yeah, you'll get a write-off in your small business, but now you've created income. You've got a write-off as rent, but now you have income as renting one of your homes. So now you've got depreciation. If you go to sell your home, you could have problems. So you want to be really careful with that. So watch out. I would say a very reasonable deduction is usually about 10 to 20% of your home for business, because you're probably storing supplies in the garage. You may be using other spaces of the home for meetings, things like that. So I think you can sell that to an IRS agent and not be too aggressive. But 50-50, I think, is going way too far. Got a question here from Kathy. She says, thanks so much, Kathy, for the question here. She says, writing off my cell phone, I am not employed, but I do manage the rental property, one single family home rental. We purchased it last year, and I'm pursuing purchasing property this year, hopefully 4+ doors. And I'm working towards gaining real estate professional status. Woo! Well, Kathy, then she says, while we just have one rental, can I still deduct my cell phone from the rental property income? With your advice, we have not set up an LLC or an entity yet. Kathy, here's the deal. Let's go in reverse. First of all, you don't have to have an LLC to take this write-off. As everybody knows out there, and I'm sure you, Kathy, you know this too, is that the LLC is going to give you protection, not per se the ability for a write-off. The whole purpose of the LLC is for the protection. And I remember our conversation, Kathy, too, with one little rental. We were going to hold off on this LLC until you had a couple more rentals, because you're in this California expensive state where we do need an LLC at some point, but we want to be cautious when we pull that trigger. Now, with cell phone, though, Kathy, I would write off 100% of your cell phone. Freak yeah. You own a small business. You're stay-at-home, manage the rental property business. You need a cell phone for that. And as long as you have a home phone line separate from your cell phone, you can write off 100% of that cell phone, because you have a small business, you need a cell phone to stay in touch with your property management and your tenant, and there's nothing wrong with that. So I would go for it. I think it's a great question and a great comment. I'm hitting send and receive here. If anybody throws out another question here, we just got a few more minutes left, and I want to head over to a question by Larissa. Larissa says, Mark, you were awesome. I love your show. Never miss it. Here are my questions for the show. You rock, Larissa. Thank you so much. She says, under the American Taxpayer Relief Act, I don't know if there's much relief there, but okay, anyway, that's what they called it. Under the American Taxpayer Relief Act, for taxpayers whose income exceeds $400,000 for single filers and $450,000 for joint filers, the capital gains tax was increased from 15 to 20%. That is correct. Does this income include the capital gain itself? For example, if you sell your real estate property, in calculation of this $400,000, or is it only regular income like your W-2 income? What income are we talking about? AGI or what? Well, we are talking about your adjusted gross income, and it's going to include your capital gain itself. Now, keep in mind here, Larissa, that before your tax rate kicks in, you're going to have an opportunity to write off all your business deductions, any rental property deductions, potentially, depending on if you qualify as a real estate professional or not. The capital gain itself would be reduced by any carry forward passive losses that you've been bringing along, and you're going to be able to use your itemized deductions. So this is your taxable income after everything. If it exceeds 400 grand, single, 450,000 married, you're going to pay this higher tax rate on the capital gain portion of that income. So I know that it may sound a little technical, but Larissa, the answer is all of your income is thrown in that bucket. All of your write-offs are thrown in that bucket. And if you make more than 400 grand or 450, and part of that's capital gain, you don't get capital gain treatment on it, you are writing off that. So you're going to be paying that higher tax rate on that. Now, she says the same question for a new Medicare tax of 3.8% on unearned net investment income for taxpayers with AGI of 200 grand for individuals or 250 grand for married couples. Will this AGI include the capital gain itself, or is that regular income like W-2? Okay, well, the new Medicare 3.8% unearned net investment income does include capital gain. So we've got to be very cautious when you go to sell real estate if you're going to have huge capital gain. This is why the real estate folks have been frustrated, because they're like, oh, this is a new 3.8% tax on real estate. Well, it's not really a 3.8% tax on real estate. It's only if you make more than 200, 250 grand is there going to be this 3.8% on the portion above 250,000. But Larissa, you're right. It sucks. Now, that's the Medicare tax for Obamacare. So you're paying for Obamacare with that one. Thank you for doing that. If no one's told you thank you, I want to tell you thank you. You now have your official thank you from us as Americans. We appreciate you paying for Obamacare. Sorry, that was rude. I didn't mean to be rude. I was mocking the tax itself. I'm sorry. Okay, one. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, now one last question here. This is from Kathy. This is a great question. She says, Mark, thanks for the, you know, I just hit the cell phone. But she says, I can't write off my home internet, can I? Well, I don't know, Kathy. If you've got a rental property and you're buying more rental property and you're searching on the web and you're returning emails, talking to your property manager and your tenant and your lawyer and your CPA and your realtor, aren't you needing that internet for your small business? I would say yes. Now, when it comes to internet, I might be a little less aggressive when you only have one rental property in your life. I may not want to write off 100% of the internet, maybe half of it. I could be good with that. You need the internet to be a property manager, but you are going to use it for personal emails, Facebook, yada, yada. So I think you should be able to write off a good portion of your internet, maybe just not all of it. So I think that's an excellent excellent question. Okay, I'm just doing a little search here to see if we have any final questions before the break. Does Magic Jack used as fax and phone count as home phone? Michelle, great question. Yes, I would say it does. You're going to be using your internet for that. Now, the trick is based on Kathy's question just a moment ago, if you're using internet for Magic Jack so you can have a home phone line, then I'd write off 100% of your cell phone. I don't know if I would, if I was an IRS agent, I don't know if I'd buy off 100% of your internet. Probably a portion of your internet, because a portion of it's going towards Magic Jack. But bottom line, Michelle, let me say, I would write off 100% of your cell phone if you're using Magic Jack. The question then becomes, how much of your internet do we want to write off? So, great question. Well, folks, I want to say this again. You have just spent one of the most valuable hours of the week listening to the Mark Kohler Show with yours truly, and I want to say thank you and encourage you to please tune in every week at 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 Eastern, to the show here, where I hope to wow you with tax and legal tips,
that are going to change your life. So keep living the dream. Don't give up. Please send out a little link to the show. Please like me on Facebook. Let the world know we're here. And I really appreciate your business and your following. Thank you. Thank you so much. Have an awesome day.
Thanks for listening to another hour of refreshing strategies to better live your American dream.
Don't forget to get your free copy of Mark and Matt's ebooks and sign up for their weekly free newsletter with important tax deadlines and articles at refreshyourwealth.com.